This is the State of Things. I'm Phoebe Judge. Walk into most bowling alleys and you'll come across a similar scene. Bowlers of all ages rolling balls down lanes with the hopes of sending a strike echoing through the building. While the setup for bowling hasn't changed much over the years, the sport's popularity has seen some peaks and valleys. It reached a peak in the 1960s, with more than 12,000 alleys built within the decade. But by the 80s, bowling began to wane. In her latest novel, Quinn Dalton uses bowling's rise and fall as the backdrop for a coming-of-age love story. The book is called Midnight Bowling. Quinn hosts a book event at the Village Lanes Bowling Alley in Durham tomorrow. But first, she joins me in the studio. Welcome, Quinn.
Thank you so much, Phoebe.
Quinn, what sparked your interest to write a book about bowling? You didn't have much experience with the sport before writing the book.
No, it really came about because of a story a friend had told me. And so writers do this all the time. We paint ourselves into corners. And I can tell you quickly, it was a friend of a friend who was telling a story about growing up in what was then rural Georgia and became sucked into what is now the megalopolis of Atlanta. But back then, the only thing that there was to do for teens was to go to the bowling alley. And he talked to me about midnight bowling. That's what they did. And I said, what is that? And he told me that they would do that on Friday and Saturday nights. And he would stand there with the lights and the music and pretend that he was somewhere else. And that was how he knew he had to leave. And after he told me that story, I couldn't get it out of my head.
How did you conduct research for this novel as a bowling novice?
As a complete ignorance when it came to bowling, I started out by just having conversations. Initially, this Midnight Bowling was a short story, and it was in my first collection, Bulletproof Girl, and I just didn't feel that I was done with it. When I wrote that, I was able to just go online and just get a few brush strokes, but when we were working on a novel, I needed to know more. So I did. I read about the history of bowling. I read about I read memoirs of pro bowlers. And then when I decided that I wanted to set this story specifically in Sandusky, Ohio, it had been an unspecified town before, I started talking to people in Sandusky. I called them up and like a flake and said, hey, I'm writing a novel. Can I come visit you? And I spent days at the Star Lanes up there, which the Galaxy Lanes is based on, and interviewed the sons of the owners, pro bowlers, the high school bowling coach, pretty much anyone I could talk to. That's how I did it.
So tell us about bowling's golden era in the mid-20th century.
From what I understand, and of course it's only what I'm hearing, you know, when I talked with people and what I read about, is that bowling really was very much part of the fabric of American society, particularly in the Midwest and the Northeast. Not to say it wasn't also very popular in the South, but that was its home ground. And then that just started to change. I think it changed because of the things that were going on socially and politically in the country, the social upheavals that started to, for better or worse, change the nature of the nuclear family, and bowling also, and along with that, bowling was very much organized around churches. And where you worked, if you were part of a union, you would have a bowling league. And so, especially in the Midwest and Northeast, as the unions started to, you know, all those jobs went away, then the bowling went away too, and it just became something that was no longer considered even wholesome or part of the family. It was just something that was in decline.
Well, let's stick with it while it's popular for a minute. Was this a regional phenomenon? I mean, did everyone bowling, people in the Midwest? Why choose Ohio? Was it a hot spot for bowling?
I think certainly, yes, the Midwest and Ohio, certainly. There's a lot of Germans in Ohio. My father's of German descent. And so that was, you know, it came from Germany. And so there was that. I lived in Ohio for a time. My parents still live there. I went to high school and college at Kent State, and so I'm familiar with that territory, so that's why.
So during this rise of bowling, it also became a common sport on network I don't think I've ever seen a more boring sport than bowling on television, but it was very popular for a while.
There's always golf. Golf could be more boring, yes.
How did TV influence bowling's popularity?
Well, I think that just solidified it. what was already happening. Bowling for Dollars was one of the shows, and, you know, just game shows around bowling. So it was just, you know, American television was on the rise at the same time that bowling was in its heyday. And so it was just a natural fit.
So bowlers were becoming celebrities also
yes.
at this time. And I want to play a clip of an old beer commercial with famous bowler Billy Hardwick.
Billy Hardwick. The man has won more professional tournaments in 1 year than any other bowler in history. In the first three games he ever bowled, Billy scored 79, 87, and 69. So he practiced a lot, day after day, night after night. Billy puts it this way. You've got to have real desire and dedication about anything you do if you're going to do it right. It's the same with Miller High Life. We've dedicated over 115 years to brewing the best beer there is. We brew it hearty, robust, deep down good. Miller makes it right.
That's a Miller beer commercial from 1969, Bowling on the Radio. My guest is Greensboro author Quinn Dalton. Her new book is called Midnight Bowling. She hosts a book event tomorrow at the Village Lanes in Durham. This era that you set the novel is basically on the decline of bowling, and you could have put it in this golden era, but you put it in the decline. Why choose to set it in that picture?
Well, there's never any story worth reading, listening to, or telling when there isn't something at stake. And when everything's great, there's really no story. So it seemed natural to set it in that time when there's a sense of the known and the familiar and the stable slipping away, which is exactly what is happening with the main narrator, Tess Wacheski, in the story. She's losing everything she knows, too, and is having to make some decisions that will affect the rest of her life.
Well, tell us about the two main characters in the book, Tess and Leo Florida.
Tess Wacheski is a teenage star bowler from Sandusky, Ohio. And her father before her was a pro bowler, but had a terrible start that kind of paralyzed him and ended his career immediately. His coach, who becomes her coach, is Leo Florida. He's an ex-hustler and a shady guy kind of all around, who becomes the owner of the Galaxy Lanes where everybody's lives intersect. And those two men, Joe Wacheski, her father, and Leo Florida, who is the other voice in the book, are kind of two opposite poles in Tess's life, and sort of are these forces pulling her within which she has to make her own path.
Why did you choose to write the book from these two different perspectives?
At first, the short story was only from Tess's perspective. As I worked on this novel, and I worked on it a long time and kept getting stuck, I finally realized that although Tess is a brilliant and exciting young woman, she was not able to tell the whole story. And so I needed another voice, and I wanted one that was in big contrast to her. And so Leo Florida, being kind of an old, grumpy, crusty, shady bowling alley owner, seemed to be perfect for that.
They're pretty different.
Yes.
Well, will you read a passage for us and set up the scene a little bit?
Absolutely. This is just the first two paragraphs, the opening paragraphs of the novel. So there's really not a lot of setup needed other than this is Tess Wacheski's voice. 2 million people watched that day in January 1963 when my father choked at the Pro Bowling Championship at the Showboat in Las Vegas. Everybody he knew had seen it, and he had plenty of time to think about that on the drive home to Sandusky. He was in the car. His coach, Leo Florida, had left him before he skipped town. Leo had also left him some cash, but he was gone, and my father was alone and only 17 years old. And before that, he hadn't been as far as Cincinnati on his own. Since then, not a word from Leo for a decade. No one, including Leo's own family, knew where he'd gone, though there were plenty of theories. He was back on the hustling circuit. He'd become a communist spy. He'd gone to jail. He was dead. The last two lines gaining ground when he didn't show up for his own mother's funeral. I didn't know about any of this when my father took me to the Galaxy Lanes for the first time. It was my 9th birthday, November 8th, 1973, and he'd just gotten a promotion in engineered fittings. So he said we had a lot to look forward to. And not only that, he said, Leo, Florida was back in Sandusky. There was, of course, no way for me to know what this meant to him, even if he tried to explain it, who he'd been before I was born, what he'd hoped for and dreamed for, and how I figured into any of it.
That's Greensboro author Quinn Dalton reading from her new novel, Midnight Bowling. She hosts a book event tomorrow at the Village Lanes in Durham. Quinn, Tessa's faced with the choice to carry out her father's legacy as a bowler or forge her own path. That's a pressure that we see throughout the book. Will you tell us more about it?
Sure. Part of what Tess is struggling with is the loyalty that she feels for her father is compounded, and this is not really much of a spoiler because you learn this in the first chapter, is that she loses him. He dies, you know, you find this out very early in the story that this is coming. And so her loyalty to him and to the life they've had together is so strong that it's an orbit she can almost not escape from.
How does Leo's story emphasize the book's theme of redemption?
Well, I think Leo is a perfect example of the redemption that comes from loving in spite of all odds. You wouldn't expect this of Leo. He's a very tough guy, a tough talker, and he almost doesn't respect Tess's father because Tess's father is an artist. He believes in the beauty of the game, whereas Leo is about winning. But Leo has a love that it's a love at first sight, and he spends a lifetime nurturing that love despite the fact that because of unavoidable circumstances, the woman he loves cannot be with him. So I think that redeems him.
Will you read another passage for us and tell us what's happening here?
Sure. This is at the end of the first chapter, and it is setting up what Tess believes is ahead of her. As the story opens. Bowling wasn't exactly glamorous. Not anymore, at least. Though the framed black and white photos on Leo's Hall of Fame wall made me wish that men still wore suits and women tight-waisted, full-skirted dresses, sitting in neat rows to watch the hometown matches. My father said it didn't matter that those days were gone. It didn't matter that the Galaxy wasn't a showplace anymore, or that the unions were on their backs in our town and across the Midwest while the good jobs blew away, or that thousands of men, some of them scarcely a decade older than me, had streamed from the jungles of Vietnam to the veterans' home on Columbus Avenue, many of them missing this or that part, some of them still seeming to be on the lookout for them. What mattered was that perfection could still be had in the form of a ball curving with just the right spin toward its target. Correct action could prevail. Don't let Leo make you think the how doesn't matter, my father said to me over and over again. Maybe he worried from the beginning that Leo would ruin me like he'd nearly ruined him. Anyway, I didn't care. I believed my father when he said the past didn't matter. The important thing was that he was my coach, and we were the perfect combination, natural-born talent and experience. All we needed was each other. We knew this the way we knew the order of pinfall in a perfect strike, left-handed or right-handed, or the number of boards a ball had to hook across to make that strike. What we didn't know was the number of years and months and days we had left together, which were 7, 5, and 2, respectively. That math, simple and final as it turned out to be, was beyond us.
That's Greensboro author Quinn Dalton reading from her new novel, Midnight Bowling. She hosts a book event tomorrow at the Village Lanes in Durham. Quinn, bowling has seen a recent revitalization, and I wanted to tell us more about this, but also tell us how this movie, The Big Lebowski, has kind of helped us all get back bowling.
Well, I had a conversation with Bill Verner, who is a member of the Splitskrieg Bowling League that meets on Monday nights, I believe, at the Village Lanes. And the head of the Splitskrieg Bowling League, who I'm looking forward to meeting, is Russ Dean. And Bill tells me he joined this league about 10 years ago. He has been in the book business before. He's a librarian at Duke. And so this is a very kind of literary hipster bowling set. When he said hipster in the same sentence as bowling, I felt like I needed him to explain. And he said this league and a lot of leagues like it exist because of the Big Lebowski.
Okay, well, we don't have much time, but let's play the clip. Let's hear from the Big Lebowski from the movie.
Over the line!
Huh?
I'm sorry, Smokey. You were over the line. That's a foul.
Bullshit. Mark at 8, dude.
Smokey, this is not Nam. This is bowling. There are rules.
Hey, Walter, come on. It's just, hey, man, it's Smokey. So his toe slipped over a little, you know? It's just a game, man.
This is a league game. This determines who enters the next round robin. Am I wrong?
Yeah, but I wasn't.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, but I wasn't over. Give me the marker, dude. I'm marking an 8.
Smokey, my friend, you're entering a world of pain.
Walter, man.
You mark that frame an 8, you're entering a world of pain.
I'm not.
A world of pain.
Look, dude, this is your partner.
Has the whole world gone crazy? Am I the only one around here who gives a about the rules? Mark at 0.
That's a clip from the 1998 movie, The Big Lebowski. My guest is Greensboro author Quinn Dalton. Her new book is called Midnight Bowling. She hosts a book event tomorrow at the Village Lanes in Durham. Quinn, are you a good bowler now?
No.
Terrible?
I'm terrible.
I would think it'd be the most wonderful skill to have to be a good bowler.
I had to talk to other people about what it felt like to when you're a good bowler, because when I was trying to describe that, one of the pros I talked to said, it's better that you just let me tell you how it feels, because I'm the one who's doing it right and you're not.
Well, we all have time for improvement. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Phoebe.
Quinn Dalton is the author of Midnight Bowling. She hosts a book event tomorrow at the Village Lanes Bowling Alley in Durham at 7. Quinn, thanks for being on the program. You can find out more about the show at our website, stateofthings.org. That's the State of Things for today. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is a technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Phoebe Judge.